So anyway, if you look up here, this is, of course, Dead Sea. You've got the Sea of Galilee up here. There's a lot of verbiage that's cluttering all of this. We talked about it a few weeks ago. And using those maps from Sterling's Atlas of the Acts that I told everybody about as we had started the class, the introductory classes, you can dig around in here until you find your numbers, and it'll give you a little bit of an outline. So in Acts chapter 9, verse 31, the church was multiplying. Number 2, Peter journeys to Lydda in chapter 9, verse 32. So here in Jerusalem, he makes this trip over to Lydda about two-thirds of the way to the coast. Then you got to hunt around until you find number 3. Here it is at Lydda. He heals Aeneas. And he has to call in to Jaffa. It's printed as Jaffa, but the Hebrews pronounce it Jaffa. So he makes the journey now over to the coast. We looked at some pictures of Jaffa. It's very identifiable to this day. Great little port, a beautiful place that you have there. And at that location, he will raise Tabitha, also known as Dorcas, from the dead, and he'll stay with Simon, whose house is by the sea, because he's a tanner. And a particular business, a curing leather, you know, they had need in for the ability to wash it. And so, you know, he'd always be by the sea with that occupation. Then, we're about to read, notice that up here, Cornelius will have a vision. He will send for Peter. Peter's going to preach to them. He and his household, Cornelius, that is, will come to Christ. And then Peter's going to come back to Jerusalem. So we're just making this little journey right here. Not a lot of miles, but take a day or two to get to any one of these places. Okay, then this is the seaport and aerial view of Caesarea. If you're here on Sunday night 2 weeks ago, then we have a whole lesson on this. It is one of the most spectacular cities in all of the Mediterranean and in all of the world 2,000 years ago. It's an engineering marvel. You can see some of the remnants underwater now, the broken down walls, from what used to be harbors that reached over 1,000 feet out into the sea. Magnificent place that Herod had invested an enormous amount of time in. In the next photograph, which was one I had not shown in any of these other lessons, imagine that you're standing over here and you're going to be looking across the coast like that, you'd be looking to the north, and this is another aerial shot that shows you then the stadium that Herod built. This is the promontory upon which he had his palace. This is the area where the judgment seat would be that Paul will later, excuse me, and others will be tried. This is the hippodrome where they had the horse races that took place. Then there's a bunch of storage facilities right here, and then a main part of the city, more bays that were used for the ships that were coming in, you know, so you had a more commercial area up there to the north. But this here, this is all the city now, as you'll see it today. Up here, by the way, I mentioned the aqueduct, but you can see that straight line right here in the far north. For 8 miles, they built that aqueduct to carry water from the far north, 8 miles away, you know, back into the town. So all the fresh water from the city was supplied by that aqueduct, which, of course, was complete in those days, but has fallen into some disrepair over 2 millennia. Okay, so we'll turn all that off. We're going to come back to that at the end of the class. I'll need some men to volunteer for tonight. But let's come on into Acts chapter 10 itself. So, in chapter 10, verse 1, there was a certain man at Caesarea named Cornelius, a centurion of what was called the Italian cohort. Now, you want to be careful here. Yes, centurion means 100. But the Caesareans here discovered that, you know, they weren't necessarily all that very precise about these units. So while roughly it is so, you know, you have 100 guys in it, it's not like it at number 101, you know, they give the guy his papers and tell him he can't be in the army anymore because we don't have the right number of guys and we can't find groups for you. And so they vary, you know, to some extent. But if you're a centurion, you are a soldier who is a career soldier, and you are a man then who has, you know, what we might call gravitas, I guess. You meet soldiers today, and you meet a commander of any kind, you know, you're meeting somebody who can handle himself. You're meeting somebody that knows how to deal with a problem. You're meeting somebody that understands authority. You're meeting somebody who knows how to take orders, but he also knows how to give orders.
you're meeting an individual that's really pretty, you know, solid in life. The Romans, of course, were proud of their military, and there was great honors, there is today in our country, in being involved in military service. And so, if you're dealing with a centurion, you are dealing with a man who is intelligent, he is disciplined, he is an individual who can handle problems. This is an accomplished kind of a soul. You know, he's no pushover, he's no liberty gibbet, he's serious. And so, he's also, we will discover in verse 2, a devout man. There's a lot of soldiers who aren't, and they're accomplished in the ways of the world, but this is also a devout man who, in verse 2, feared God with all his household. So it's not even just that he's devout, but he has been able to influence his entire household. Now, again, be careful. A household need not at all be limited to an immediate family. For me, in our culture at times, when we think of a household, we think of mom and dad and the kids. With a few exceptions, we might include, you know, the grandparents on one side of the other that may have come, you know, to live with a family. But it is extremely unusual for us, really, to have two generations, let alone three, let alone servants. But with this centurion's household, that's more likely what we're looking at. An accomplished man of some means, also financially accomplished, and a very busy man with a lot of authority. So, you know, he's busy. He's got things to be doing. The household is going to include then, in these days, times, and circumstances, the immediate family, but it also likely is including maybe other generations of his family, as well as servants, which are including as well, not just what you would think of, somebody that polishes silver, you know, and cooks my meals for me, but somebody who might have been involved in some extent in some business dealings too. Well, like a foreman, we might say, but a steward. And so this can be a pretty successful guy, and it can be a pretty extensive household. And we don't know what the numbers are, but there are many kind of different elements that are tied up in it. And he's fearing God with all his household. Well, it's not just his kids who have to go to church, you know, like our kids do, because we make them kind of it. But this says they feared God with all his household. The household feared God. The household was of an age. These individuals, whether immediate family or servants or other relationships that he had perhaps in business, you know, these are adults who have made a conscious, individual, personal decision to serve their God, and it appears to be as a result of this man and his influence. And it says, he gave many alms to the people. Now note there, the word Jewish is in italics, isn't it? It's not in the original text, but it certainly is required, implied by that original text. He is talking about, we are talking here, about an individual who is himself not a Jew. He's not a Jew. He's a Gentile. He wasn't born into a Jewish family. He was born into a Roman family, a Gentile family. And this man now, he is recognizing, because of apparently his moving into this area, assigned there by the Roman military, the superiority of this people's religion. And that is a fascinating thing. We're going to spend no more than 60 seconds on it, I guess. But you really need to think about this. Brethren, there are not a lot of American soldiers who head off to do service, let's say, in Japan, and decide that they're going to become... is it Buddhist in Japan? Japan? Yeah. Okay. In other words, you have military service, you know, in any country, that you would look at the people and say, that's a great religion. That makes more sense than what I see. That, by the way, like our soldiers today, a Roman soldier might be really well-traveled. This is a guy who has had opportunity to consider various religions around the Roman Empire. There's a lot of them. But he's come to this place, and he's been thinking about it, and he's decided, that's the religion for me. So he's been studying. The Jews had a system, we call it proselyting, by which they were able to take converts who, though they're not native-born Hebrews, could participate in the religious exercises with certain limitations because they're not children of Abraham. So this man is really impressive. Finding that he's devout at all, you know, today as then, is impressive. Fearing God is impressive. Convincing his household or influencing them is impressive. And he gave many alms to these Jewish people and prayed to God continually. Now, pardon me.
I know I go through this and, you know, I did clear it out.
Oh, I can't do it. It's miserable for you guys. I knew it was coming in to speak for 2 weeks and all this fun stuff. So, my apologies, but we are going to have to struggle for a little bit with this today. Keep prepared this time. However, when you simply go over even now, please don't be digging in your pockets for Ricola. It's not a throat problem. It's dust in my lungs. It's pollen in there. You know, I could just reach in there with a big, long brush. I'd be in better shape. But I don't think you need your throat lozenges. You can help me here. Okay, so here we go. In verse 2 at the very end, and he also did what? What's the last designator for this man? Brethren, could you be accused of that? Could you be accused of any of this? I hope so. I hope so for myself. My personal greatest weakness certainly is in verse 2. You know, I count myself as a devout man. I fear God, and so does my household, and we certainly, you know, financially are supporting the saints, now Christians. But I'm not sure I could say I pray to God continually. I've just discovered in my own life and everybody I've ever talked to, it is hard to be really devoted to prayer. And it's just hard to be disciplined and to do it a lot. And if you are a sinner in a foreign country that is known to be a rebellious and troublesome country, and you, with all of this authority and responsibility, still find time to be a constant and continual prayer. This is a man who is just a superior human being. This is a guy who has his act together. This is a man who really is as mature and accomplished as you would expect a human being can be. And he has an open mind. He can listen. He can understand. Now verse 3, about the ninth hour of the day. Now, what time is that? 3 o'clock in the afternoon. He clearly saw in a vision. So, what he saw distinctly. It was not fuzzy in any way. He wasn't peering, you know, into a crystal ball. He wasn't looking in a mist. He saw just in sharp relief, suddenly, an otherworldly thing. And as he is experiencing this vision, an angel of God came to him and said to him, Cornelius, fixing his gaze upon him and being much alarmed, he said, What is it, Lord? And he said to him, Your prayers and alms have ascended as a memorial before God. Now, brethren, as a matter of fact, after all we've said about Cornelius, would you think of him as being kind of chicken? He's also going to be a very brave and courageous kind of guy, isn't he? He's the kind of a guy who knows what battle is about. Roman soldiers were involved in a lot of it. And so, when it says that, you know, there's a vision, and an angel spoke and named him, and he's much alarmed. This was an impressive thing. Now, what form this angel takes, you know, we don't know. One more cough. And so, but he's terrified. So what is it, Lord? And I think everybody here knows this. You're all accomplished Bible students. The word Lord is not a designation. It's reserved for God alone.
is a common everyday thing that they use, like we use sir or mister. It's just a term of respect. So we have a soldier who has risen rather high in the ranks, who is battle experienced and hardened, and he's just wilting in the presence now of the vision of an angel who knows his name and of whom he now asks, you know, what is it? What he's told is really good news. Your prayers and your alms have ascended as a memorial before God. The things that you have said to your God, he has heard. And the actions you have taken in helping the downtrodden, the less fortunate, the alms that you've given, you know, the money and whatnot to this Jewish religion, God's taken note of it. It's a memorial before him. You've done well. And now, dispatch some men to Joppa and send for a man, Simon, who is also called Peter. He's staying with a certain tanner, Simon, who is known the same name, whose house is by the sea. And when the angel who was speaking to him had departed, he summoned two of his servants and a devout soldier of those who were in constant attendance upon him. And after he had explained everything to them, he sent them to Joppa. On the next day, as they were on their way and approaching the city, about a day's trip, Peter went up on the housetop about the sixth hour to pray. Probably you got a picture of their housetops. You know, there's many artist illustrations, and then that construction is common to this day. But, you know, they've got a patio porch thing, you know, on the roof that is just very common in that land. And so here's Peter in the sixth hour of the day on the housetop. What time is this? So it's noontime. He became hungry and was desiring to eat. But while they were making preparations, he fell into a trance. And he beheld the sky opened up and a certain object, like a great sheet coming down, lowered by four corners to the ground. And there were in it four-footed animals and crawling creatures of the earth and birds of the air. Now, Mike, take just a moment to point out that there are different kinds of revelation that God has employed through the ages. If you have a dream, which is not mentioned in this context, then how and when does God contact you? Okay, while you're asleep. Raise your hand if you've never had a dream. I mean that, I'd be interested. I see, I don't think there's a single exception. We've all had this experience. Was God talking to us? No, don't think so. God came in a dream. And so in that state, God chose to communicate. It does not happen in this one. Then you can have a vision. In a vision, what happens?
You have an appearance while you're awake.
Okay, this is exactly it. In a vision, you have consciousness and therefore also recognition of the world, you know, about you. In a dream, what are you seeing about your bedroom? Nothing. Well, see, your eyes are closed, you're asleep, so you don't have any sensory input, at least in the eyes, you know, from the environment. In a vision, you do. In a vision, apparently, you've got both of these worlds kind of overlapping, one superimposed, you know, over the other. Now, in this case, though, it talks about a trance. What is a trance? And can you have a vision without one? So what's a trance? The guy's in a trance.
Sort of a state of unconnected mental state.
Okay, in a trance, you're not asleep. And you are overwhelmed, transfixed, you know, involved with whatever form of communication God is giving to you. But
are you able to walk about or move or you know, numb? And so in a trance, you get fixated. You get kind of locked down, you know, if you will. Very intense experience then. Now, do people today have trances? Sure, people today have visions. In both cases, I mean, God has got a thing in the world to do with it. I saw a guy yesterday. I'm pretty sure he was experiencing a vision. I always thought that they built the highway to the northeast, you go to the shopping center, and I got out of there and I had to go south. And so I was south of the Delta Highway, and I got off of that off-ramp that takes you to the Valley River Center. Then I came up to the light. I was going to make a left-hand turn away from the river center, but I came up to the light, and I was the second car waiting at the light. So off to my left, very clearly, I could see a guy coming across the bridge. He's on foot, and he's coming across the bridge, you know, over the Delta Highway, and he's coming at an unusually rapid pace. You know, you can tell. And it was kind of animated, the way he was working his hands and stuff, you know, caught my attention. Oh, yeah, I see this guy. And he's got on a t-shirt that's from the U of O, you know, he's advertising the Dutch somehow. He's got a short pair of pants, it's really hot. You know, and there was just something really odd about this guy. And it not only caught my attention, but I went on alert. Okay? Could be some trouble coming down the road right here this time. So he comes up to that car that's immediately in front of me, and as he's passing, let me do this so you can see, but as he's passing, he just locks eyes on the driver. He's doing this thing, you know, but he stares at this driver as he goes by. And then there was a turtle. Wow. There was a turtle in him, and then he goes to the next car, and he stares at them, you know, the whole way. And I notice as I go by, he's got green socks on, and no shoes. What do you got? He is in another world. And I don't know what he was thinking, but I'm pretty sure it wasn't just Cheerios and milk. You know, something happened in that head. So we didn't have these kinds of experiences today, but did it have anything with God to do with God? No. God chooses these conditions known to man and demonstrates that he is able to communicate through these things as well during or in these things. In this particular case, you have, of course, guys, don't take drugs by any means, and an angel was sent to Cornelius, and now, in a trance, very, you know, completely overwhelmed, Peter's going to see something too. So, we come to verse 11, where you have the description. The sky opened up. So, somehow, you know, it peels back. A portal appears. And a certain object like a great sheet coming down. It's not a great sheet, but it's like a great sheet. It's huge, giant, you know, tarp fabric thing of some kind. It's lowered by four corners, but nothing is ever mentioned as holding it. So apparently it's just suspended in the sky. And in it, you have three types of creatures, four-footed animals, crawling creatures of the earth, and birds of the air. And then you get what appears to be a disembodied voice. Arise, Peter, kill and eat. And you're frozen right now. Move, get up, arise, kill these animals, and consume them. And Peter said, by no means, Lord, for I have never eaten anything unholy and unclean. Brother, we don't know the time frame here. I've seen it estimated anywhere from about 7 to 10 years since Jesus rose from the dead. But in these 7 to 10 years since Jesus rose from the dead, was Peter, let me, I guess, use the word, technically still under Moses' law? Yes or no? No, really not. But in that length of time, had he violated any of these dietary restrictions from the Old Testament? No. Now, he was free to eat of forbidden foods as designated by the Old Testament. And this goes back to the Gospels, where Jesus made a statement statement that the inspired writer then adds, the same gift, he made all foods clean. Jesus made all foods clean. Now, Peter, though, is apparently choosing to continue to abide by those restrictions. He has a right to do that if he wants, and it would make things a whole lot easier. This is the culture that you're living in. And so, he's you know, felt, God said this before, you know, I'm going to continue to keep it. Now, again, there's a presumption that Peter understands this, and I guess I should be careful to say I don't know absolutely that that is the case. He's not getting the idea fully that he's free to eat. Now, you and I know, studying Hebrews and Romans, that he's not subject to it. But he's got a conviction. And whatever his rationale for it is, he is abiding by it without exception. Watch what happens though, and they'll all bear fruit. So, you know, no. And at 15, again, a voice came to him a second time. What God has cleansed, no longer consider unholy. And this happened three times. And immediately, the object was taken up into the sky. Now, at this point, brethren, we're all perplexed, and Peter is too, and it says so in verse 17. What is that about? And then, at this very moment, in the middle of verse 17, the men who had been sent by Cornelius, having asked directions for Simon's house, appeared at the gate. And calling out, they're asking whether Simon, who was also called Peter, was staying there. And while Peter was reflecting on the vision, the Spirit said to him, behold, three men are looking for you. But arise, go downstairs, and accompany them without misgivings, for I have sent them myself. Peter went down to the men and he said, behold, I am the one you're looking for. What is the reason for which you've come? And they said, Cornelius, a centurion, a righteous and God-fearing man, well spoken of by the entire nation of the Jews, was directed by a holy angel to send for you, come to his house, hear a message from you. So he invited him in, gave him lodging. Next day he arose, and the conversations went on that night. And the next day he arose and went away with them. Some of the brethren from Joppa accompanied him. Following day he entered Caesarea. Now Cornelius was waiting for them, called together his relatives and close friends. Larger body now. So the household's going to be involved, relatives are going to be involved, and close friends are going to be involved. And again, you have to be careful of verse 24, but, you know, there's a little bit of a presumption, I guess, here. But brethren, if he calls together his relatives, then what does that suggest? If he has to call them together,
they're
somewhere else. And it suggests that, you know, not living with him. We're just trying to get a picture of what this household is like. So I mentioned before, you might have even two, three generations living under the same roof, but at the same time, you know, it doesn't look like everybody's living under the roof. And he called together his close friends. Well, they're not living under his roof. And so he's calling together quite a few people. He's had 2 days to think about this. And so he calls all these people together. He knows he's been ordered to do it by an angel. And so he's getting as big an audience as he can. Now, in verse 25, when it came about that Peter entered, Cornelius met him, fell at his feet, and he worshipped him. What was the emotional state of Cornelius when he saw the angel? Terror. Scared to death. Now, I want you to send for a guy, and he's going to come and preach to you. Oh, boy. God's got a message for me. See, my natural inclination is to melt down, you know, just to be in the presence of this individual, whoever it was. So Peter shows up. I imagine his first thought is, mercy, forgive me. I don't know what I did wrong. You know, well, my prayers and alms have ascended. Well, that's a good thing. It's a memorial before God. But also, something big is happening. Will I be ready for whatever this is? So he throws himself at Peter's feet. He's going to worship him, does worship him. Peter responds in 26.
stand up, I too am a man. Well, now, could Cornelius have known that to begin with? What had he just seen 2 days ago? Was not a man. See, so, you go sin, somebody's coming, but what's coming? See, I don't know. So he throws himself down, and Peter has to tell him, no, just a man. Okay? So then, in 27, as he talked with him, he entered, and he found many people assembled. And he said to them, you yourselves know how unlawful it is for a man who is a Jew to associate with a foreigner or to visit him. And yet God has shown me that I should not call any man unholy or unclean. That is why I came without even raising any objection when I was sent for. And so I ask, for what reason you sent for me? Now, this is perplexing. It's hard to figure out. Doesn't Peter know that he's not under the law? Well, he doesn't seem to know it, does he? He doesn't seem to know it. And so, and you've probably heard it taught, and I've done it myself in the past, you know, just very emphatically. He had absolutely no idea whatsoever. He thought, you know, he was still bound by everything under the law. Well, brethren, that would be, you know, one, I'm going to use extreme, you know, but one end of our spectrum, let's put it that way. You know, there may be other places along that spectrum. All I'm saying is that, well, let me go at it this way. Is it possible for you to have an unclean Jew? And would it be possible to have a Jew who's a Jew in every sense of the word, but you shouldn't go in his house? Because of his uncleanness for whatever reason. You know, and so all I'm trying to do is be careful not to say too much. I don't know what was going on in these men's minds except what they tell us. He says, yes, it's unlawful. And the old law is still being practiced by an enormous number of Jews. And later, we're going to have Paul out there circumcising Timothy, which wasn't necessary for Christians. When only pleased Jews, it was a lawful necessity for a Jew. But by the time Paul's doing it, it's way beyond this event. And he's still doing it. See? It's all I'm trying to say is that sometimes the scriptures are not as plain as we think they are. And I'm getting less certain than I was when I was younger. I just don't want to read too much into it. So here's what we know. But there can be several different senses in which he might think of these things. He said in 28, you yourselves know how unlawful it is for a man who is a Jew to associate with a foreigner or to visit him. And yet God has shown me that I should not call any man, now what words does he use? Unholy or unclean. Shouldn't call any man unholy or unclean. Well, there were Jews that were unholy and unclean, and then there were Gentiles that were unholy and unclean, and they would think Jews would of Gentiles that they're all unholy and unclean. But, you know, there are kind of variations in here. And then in 29, that's why I came without even raising any objection when I was sent for, and so I asked, for what reason you sent for me?
Now, at this moment, I wish I had been there just to see the looks on these two men's faces. What are they both asking each other? Why are we here? Is that either one of them? No. And it's just such a curious moment. Well, an angel told me to come and send for you. Well, I had a vision. The boy told me to come to you. Why? So now we're here. Well, what do we do now? What is going on?
And then Cornelius says, 4 days ago to this hour. What hour is it 4 days ago? It was 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I was praying in my house during the ninth hour. Do you always pray at 3 o'clock? He's better than you, isn't he? Better than me, too.
And behold, a man stood before me in shining garments. So we didn't know that before. And he said, Cornelius, your prayer has been heard, and your alms have been remembered before God. Send therefore to the office, and invite Simon, who is also called Peter, to come to you. He's staying at the house of Simon the Tanner by the sea. So I sent you immediately, and you've been kind enough to come. Now then, we are all here, present before God, to hear all that you have been commanded by the Lord.
Carol's made an outstanding point. Have you still heard of circumcising Timothy in order to, you know, have him work with these Jews, but it would have been okay then for Timothy even to be in certain areas of the temple. See, that's exactly it. I appreciate you bringing that up by that, you know, particular aspect, but that's it. That's exactly it. And so here's this range of why he would be keeping that law. But now, something hits him. And so in 34, opening his mouth, Peter said, I most certainly understand that God is not one to show partiality, but in every nation, the man who fears him and does what is right is welcome to him. The word which he sent to the sons of Israel, preaching peace through Jesus Christ, he is Lord of all. You yourselves know the thing which took place throughout all Judea, starting from Galilee after the baptism which John proclaimed. You know Jesus of Nazareth, how God anointed him with the Holy Spirit and with power, how he went about doing good and healing all who were oppressed by the devil, for God was with him. And we are, does that next word ring any bells from months ago? Yeah, witnesses. We had those witnesses crop up quite a few times in the first few chapters. And who were they always and only? 12 apostles. We are witnesses of all the things he did, both in the land of the Jews and in Jerusalem. They also put him to death by hanging him on a cross. God raised him up on the third day, granted that he should become visible, not to all the people, but to witnesses who were chosen beforehand by God, to us who ate and drank with him after he arose from the dead. And he ordered us to preach to the people and solemnly to testify that this is the one who's been appointed by God to judge as judge of the living and the dead. Of him, all the prophets bear witness that through his name, everyone who believes in him receives forgiveness of sins. Now let's stop right here. That's a big sermon in very few words. It's a small one, but it covers a lot of territory, doesn't it? Now, brethren, again, understand the circumstances. Cornelius doesn't know why he's sending for Peter. Peter doesn't know why he's going to Cornelius. They both have supernatural, you know, contact from God. You know, and God kind of grabbed by the shoulder and said, I've got business for the two of you. They come together and ask each other what to do. And what I'm suggesting right here is, Peter's getting it. My question for you is he getting it only because he's been thinking about it for 2 days and he figured it out? Did he only just now get it because Cornelius added some piece to the puzzle? And then he figured it out. Well, if I put that together with the sheep vision and what was told to Cornelius, I get it. Or is he being inspired, filled with the Holy Spirit, and he says, now I get it? See, and I'm not sure.
I think that he's just figuring it out because he didn't know why he came to Cornelius, exactly. And it took the vision of Cornelius together with his experience to put two and two together.
Okay, and that is, you know, strongly, that idea is strongly supported by Where is it? The very thing that he said, here it is, at 34, when he first opened his mouth. I most certainly understand that God is not one to show partiality. But in every nation, the man who fears him and does what is right is welcome to God. So the kids just suggested, it looks like right then, the light came on. You know, boing. And so, he preached this. But brother, I have no doubt that what he preaches here is every word of it true. And not just his ideas, if you will. Unless you want to add the other layer. The words that he just spoke here only happened because of what two events? Cornelius' angel and his vision. So it brings them together. This is God's inspiration, which may be, and often is, just direct. Boom! Now I knew it. I didn't know it, now I do. Bang, I get it. But it looks like here, God is choosing to work with these guys, perhaps in that manner, but as well as by circumstances that are 4 days apart, and groups of people, and messengers, and this is an angel, and that's a vision. But in the end, with everything that takes place right here, let me ask you this. How impressive is it? So if you're going to say, I get it, it's like, and like you do in the movies, the body needs to fly through the air, land in the baptistry kind of thing. I really get it. And so here we have God's inspiration taking a unique and kind of very physical form, employing a vision and a trance, where this is in the sky, and now we all come together and we've got a whole bunch of people present, and he preaches verses 34 through 43, which I'm not going to spend any time on. We've already seen this sermon several times before. We saw it from Peter in chapter 2. We saw it in chapter 3. We've read it all our lives, in the Bible. I'm not going to take, a bunch of time on it. It's the story of redemption.
Yeah. Yeah, I think when Peter figures it out, he figures it out by putting the two things together, because his vision involved the consumption of unclean things, which was a tradition. Mm-hmm. But he had put that tradition together with the tradition of not associating with people until he actually arrived and confronted it.
Now see how easy this is for us now. We get more fun now. We just said, "Well, Jim, I was receptive." But you're right. It's because Peter sees it in the vision of unclean animals that he makes then a conclusion about unclean people. Okay? They're not unclean anymore. God won't have it. So I get it. Now, big question, what do you do at 4 minutes?
Yeah, okay. March, any questions?
March.
I was waving at you.
See, there were several weeks that Dawn and I stayed with him. I learned to ignore her.
Verse 34. There is a word inserted in the New American Standard, and I think it's very appropriate for this occasion. I most certainly understand now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The word now is not in the original text. Okay? But why the translators put it in there? Because what kid just said a moment ago. See, it's very important to parents that the light is coming on. I didn't get it before, but at the moment I am. Go ahead, Rob.
I agree with everything that you said about how he finally gets it to us. But I also look at verse 33, and I kind of thought that maybe that's where he started getting it to, because my translation says, "So I said to you immediately, and you have done well to come. Now, therefore, we are all present before God to hear all things commanded you by God." So if I'm Peter and he says commanded you, I'm supposed to tell you what God has commanded. That's where I was.
Yeah, and I missed that, and I really appreciate that. I hadn't thought about that. Something that Cornelius got from the angel, was really clear. The message I'll get from that guy won't come from the guy. It'll come from whom? It's going to come from God. Okay, Carol.
He brought witnesses with him. So again, keeping with the traditions and the law, he actually took more witnesses with him. what went on and why he went.
Everybody knew this was big. So Cornelius gathers, you know, his family from all around, and Peter's bringing others to, you know, observe this thing. You know, they're really, this is the summit meeting. Great. That's not, is that King James you've got there?
New King James.
New King James.
So that's what I think.
Yeah, you know, does that come to mind for anybody, that textual issue there? I haven't read the King James, you know, in so long that I don't have any...
What verse did he say?
Verse 6. Read verse 6 in the New King James there, Greg, loud enough for everybody. He will tell you what he must do. Is apparently, you know, in some of the old, ancient manuscripts, it's not even footnoted in the New American Standard, and right now I just don't know how to address the textual issue. Okay, well, with that, then, let's conclude, and we'll meet again in 10 minutes.